And we've got a public hearing on House Bill 2411. John, you want to talk to us a little bit about it? And then Mitch, you'll be up next. Or representing Brindley.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2411 is introduced by Representative Brindley. It basically would require ODOT to do a study of outdoor lighting alternatives and report back to the next legislative assembly. The study would include reviewing lighting on the state highway system, reduction of lighting glare on roadways, in parking lots, and other public places, and examining shielding and focusing type options for lighting, and also would be proposing minimum illumination standards and estimating energy savings from replacing things like mercury vapor lighting with sodium lighting.
Thank you, John. Senator Greenlee, we're ready for you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mitch Greenlee, state representative from House District 33, and I really want to thank you for holding this hearing. Perhaps if I can have a moment at the end of the session as well, I would appreciate that. We really have a problem in this state, and it's not the earth-shattering problem. It doesn't compare with the debate we had this morning and in the House. It has consequences on both sides, but it is an issue. I live at 1,200 feet overlooking the city of Portland. And I also have a place at the Oregon coast, and I spend some time sitting in a hot tub at night overlooking the city of Portland, and I compare that with being out at night at the coast, and the difference is, at the coast, you have this wonderful illumination of the stars. The sky lights up on a cloudlit night, and you can see the Milky Way and the constellations, and you can see, I'm sure our good representative who's just joined us sits at her house and looks up at night and sees an extraordinary celestial display. When I sit on my deck in Portland and look out, sometimes I can see the Big Dipper. Sometimes I can see one or two of the brightest planets. But unless there's the unusual circumstances of having fog heavily over the city, and me being high enough above it, where all of a sudden the skies get re-illuminated, I sit there and mostly what I think about is how the children of the city of Portland and other similar cities are basically robbed of the experience of getting to know their sky. And that seems to me, well, maybe not the most earth-shaking thing that happens, an important issue, because understanding how we live within our universe and understanding our relationship, and there isn't anything like standing outside in a dark place and seeing the sky and understanding what our relationship with our universe really is. It really puts our humanity in place. And as I began to think about this, I also began to get email from my constituents about such things as there being a brightly lighted parking lot and they living on the fourth floor of an apartment in the city part of my district and not being able to sleep at night because of the useless illumination that lights their bedroom through darkening shade because of what's happening all around them. My interest in actually turning this into a bill came about when our transportation committee, the Interim Transportation Committee, had a hearing in Sandy, as you remember, early in the year, and we'll hear in a bit from the city manager of Sandy where the testimony was that not only did they have light-sparing ordinances in Sandy to prevent light pollution, and not only is it useful from an aesthetic and from an education perspective, but it's also economically feasible. And you'll hear some testimony about that today. So you'll also hear testimony from ODOT suggesting that they may have already done what this bill asks to do. So what I hope we'll have in this hearing is the ability to hear from a technical expert on the issues about skylighting, from Sandy about their experience with an ordinance similar to this, a local ordinance similar to this, and ODOT talking about what sounds like wonderful work that they've been doing to try and deal with this illumination issue in the future designs of our state road system. And then I'd like to just pop back in and talk about where we need to go with, I think, an amendment to this bill, or at least to work towards an amendment to this bill that will maybe take us beyond where ODOT is already taken. Thank you very much.
Thank you. In my district, a good share of my district, we can see the stars very well. And I have to relate a event that happened about 5 years ago. We, Sandy and I and our grandkids went up to a lookout station and spent the night up there. And honest to Pete, you could feel like you could reach up and touch those stars. They were so brilliant. And actually, there were so many stars, it was hard for me to find my favorite Orion and the Dipper, because there's so many stars that we do not see. So I appreciate this. Questions? Yes.
I hate to burst your bubble much, but as much as the same in my district too, but most of the people out where I live have security lights in their yard, and it's for safety. But what we'll do is we'll go around behind the house and then look up and see the Milky Way and all the stars.
Well, I think what you'll hear testimony today is that you can get the same security effect, because the issue of security is getting light on the ground and near the ground level, and that there are now technological solutions where you can use unidirectional lighting to achieve the kind of illumination you need on the ground, as opposed to the much more typical omnidirectional lighting, which lights up the barn, the sky, and the neighborhood. And that I don't think we want to do anything that ends up not putting the light into the area for security and for a variety of other reasons that we need to do. But what you can do is do two things. You can get the lighting going unidirectional onto the ground and making sure that there's not more light than you need, so you don't get the rebound of the light off the ground into the sky, and also just not waste all the energy you need shining that light upward as well as downward.
Yes.
Thanks. This is like deja vu all over again for me, because the city of Bend went through an outdoor lighting ordinance process a while ago, and we had a lot of this debate. And when I was on the board of directors for the Park District, we had the same discussion, outdoor lighting at Vince Kennedy Baseball Stadium and those types of things. And as you pointed out, Representative Greenlick, I mean, being able to see the stars is nice. And we've got, actually in his district, but east of Bend, Pine Mountain Observatory, which the University Board has under contract and stuff. So this is an important issue to a lot of people for many reasons. Security as well as just being able to see the stars. So I'm anxious to hear the rest of the testimony and see where this may go.
Pass it out first.
Sure, I'll take it.
Hello, I'm Jason Tungy. My background began with my education at the University of Colorado Boulder, the lighting program there. I'm really dedicated to the lighting profession, even though you'll see that I'm actually in sales. Might cast a little doubt there. I'm definitely dedicated to lighting. Spent the last 4 years working for an outdoor lighting manufacturer, and I'm now focusing on exterior lighting within the sales organization. I stumbled across the legislation about a month ago and then asked to meet with Mitch, and we did that about a few weeks ago, and found that we did agree on the basic idea here. His main interest, as he indicated, is dealing with light pollution, generally obtrusive light. Light pollution has been an issue for quite a while, and so has glare. And in the lighting profession, we have terminology to describe this, and it's also been quantified, so you don't just generically describe what's going on. light trespass and sky glow are both parts that make up light pollution. Light trespass is really just light falling onto other people's properties. That's actually probably the biggest issue these days from what I see on a day-to-day basis. Can really hold up a lot of projects. So it's becoming a really major issue. Sky glow is what we've been talking about most of the time here. And really that's light either directly cast in the sky or bounced off the ground and back up into the sky. And that's usually because you've got too much bounce onto the ground, like maybe in a car dealership or something. Glare is another issue that, as I've noted here, when you've got light in the higher angles, that's when it becomes riskier light, more likely to cause discomfort for people walking around, and also capable of disabling drivers and making for a hazardous situation if you've got pedestrians walking in front of them or other obstacles to avoid. Like I said, this problem has been around for a while, and it's being taken very seriously across the country. Currently, you've got three major organizations addressing this. The Illuminating Engineering Society of North America. The abbreviation is shown here so that you can go online and look these guys up. It's just www.isna.org. And they really focus on the quantitative aspects of the issue. They've got cutoff classifications that are used and often confused in the industry. These address all three issues at the same time, mostly for glare and for sky glow, but also regarding light trespass. The International Dark Sky Association is actually much larger than the Illuminating Engineering Society because it's made up of a lot of just amateur stargazers, just people like us concerned with sky glow. They've got quite a bit of power and have influenced a lot of governmental agencies across the country. And they're in the process of creating a model lighting ordinance, which will be used as kind of a template for cities across the country. You've also got the U.S. Green Building Council. They've come up with a system for giving building owners credit for being basically earth-friendly. And one portion of that credit aid is dedicated to exterior lighting. And then finally, those first three are really just recommendations. That's not something legal. When you get into the, you've got some city, state, and county ordinances as well that are law. And an example would be California Title 24. That one's mostly geared towards energy issues, not so much toward light pollution, et cetera. One thing that's a little bit dangerous when you're talking about addressing light pollution is forgetting why you're lighting in the first place. You don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Make sure that you're producing the light that you need down here on Earth, and then do what you can to reduce the side effects, like obtrusive light and system cost. You'll see a lot of ordinances around the country that use incorrect terminology and basically make some unrealistic demands. It's good to consult a professional to make sure that you really know what you're talking about when you put these into the law. So basically my recommendations are to establish first your requirements for safety and security. That's why we're lighting in the first place. And I would look to the ISNA for those quantitative criteria. Also establish restrictions for obtrusive light. Make sure, like I mentioned before, that it's actually quantified and realistic. Keep system costs in mind. We've got to be practical here. The maintained is usually more important than the initial cost. And then also keeping in mind that, like now, budgets can be fairly tight and they might get tighter. So it's good to have a plan in advance for what you're going to do to adjust to accommodate the restricted budgets. determine which of these three are going to take priority and put them in order, so you keep track of which is really the most important. It's easy to lose track of that. And then finally, consult your local experts. There's a local chapter of the IES up in Portland, based up in Portland. And if you go to their website, you can find other professionals to bounce questions off of. You don't want to go just with me. Remember, I'm in sales. there are additional professionals throughout the state and throughout the country that you can question. And I'd recommend asking several, not just one. That's all I've got.
Okay. Scott?
Yeah. Chairman Gilman and members of the committee, I'm Scott Lazenby, city manager for the city of Sandy. Several years ago, through the interest of residents who were familiar with the International Dark Sky Association, they urged us to look into it. Our mayor did some research directly at the website for the Dark Sky organization, found the model ordinance, and our planning staff made some modifications to fit our needs, and then we did adopt it. It's been in place for a couple of years. We've had some commercial development under the new ordinance, and I think it's had a good effect for us. It doesn't just deal with astronomy and being able to see the stars. There is a lot of aesthetic issues from the glare, especially commercial operations. While we were going through the process of enacting this, we had a new big box store come to Sandy. It was a Fred Meyer store. They voluntarily agreed to follow the standards in our new ordinance, and I think it made a real difference. They still have lighting in the parking lot, but they use lower shoebox-type fixtures, less intensity, and it directs the light right to the parking lot. And we even talked about reducing the levels after the business was closed, a few hours after the business would close, reduce it even further just to provide a minimal security level. And one thing I should add, too, on a residential standpoint, especially in the rural area around us, it's people with ridiculous lights in their barns and things that are cause more of the neighborhood complaints. We had a lot of interest in the rural area, although our ordinance obviously doesn't apply out there. There's been a lot of study as to whether security lights do, in fact, provide security, and I think the facts are that they don't. It's a false level of security that burglars don't like working in the dark, and the lights actually help them. And you do need lights. The main safety issue is to avoid tripping over your lawn chair or your dog when you go outside. But as far as the lighting, it's actually better not to have any at all, or to have on a motion detector if the home is actually occupied. But beyond that, people, have misperceptions about the effect of lighting and how much you need. There is a good work in the industry that's really helping this. As Representative Crowley mentioned, our own Parks Board has struggled with this with a ball field that we put together with volunteer efforts prior to the dark sky ordinance. But there are exceptions for ball fields, too, because they're not on that often. But if we had used lighting that really focused the light on the field, it would have been more expensive initially, but it would have been more effective in the long run because we would have had a brighter field at less operating costs. For the intensity you get where you want it, you're not spraying the light all over the neighborhood and basically wasting that energy. So in hindsight, I wish we'd have had those kind of standards in place when we did our ball fields. And it is an aesthetic issue for the neighbors. We have seen from the folks that talk to us, the commercial side, that in their analysis of energy use, going to these different outdoor lighting standards does save money. It saves energy bills. And so I think it's a win-win situation. Now, given that there are model ordinances that both cities and counties can adopt, especially for new construction, frankly, I'm not certain there's necessarily a state role in this. Most of the major effects are local. Yeah, we're affected by the Portland lights, but there's a lot of jurisdictions out there, including Vancouver, and I think it'd be hard to make a huge difference from the astronomy standpoint. Locally, we can make a big difference in how the aesthetics of our own community work out for our residents and people passing through. These things are easy to adopt, and again, with the technology out there, we do follow. And I'll leave a copy of our ordinance for the committee. We refer to standard industry standards for what kind of lamps people will use. We have had to buy a light meter to actually check and enforce this, but other than that, it's pretty straightforward.
Any questions? Thank you. John Johnson. John?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Jackley with the Highway Division at ODOT. Appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon. In terms of our highway lighting practices, of course, safety is always our top consideration, but we do put a tremendous amount of time and effort and thought into the lighting, into the illumination issues, and all of our highway lighting systems are designed to control both glare and light trespassing. And to ensure that the amount of lighting is both proper for safety and not excessive to add to the light pollution problem, we follow the national standards of the American Association of State Highway Transportation Officials, the Illuminating Engineering Society, and the Federal Highway Administration. Our lighting systems have been designed to direct most of the light downward for roadway illumination, and our typical highway lighting apparatus has about 97% of the light shine downward. At the same time, we're always looking for ways to improve outdoor lighting and to reduce these kind of problems. All of our new installations use lights that are designed to control this kind of glare and light trespassing. We're replacing some of the technical systems, such as mercury and metal halide lighting systems, with more efficient, newer systems that both cost less and use less energy. We're also using reflective sheeting on signs when we can, which eliminate the need for a lot of outdoor lighting. Probably the most important change we've made was in January 2003, we changed our lighting policy to provide what we call partial interchange lighting. We found that we could reduce lighting at most of our interchanges by about 50% without compromising safety. We also have a trial underway that reduces highway lighting at many interchanges even further below that, and we'll have evaluation results of that study later this year. And possibly most importantly, in terms of the conversation and the direction that this bill is seeking to go in, our state traffic engineer is currently a member of the National AASHTO subcommittee that is redoing the national standards for highway illumination. And because of Oregon and the department's interest, longstanding interest in this issue, he and the other members of that subcommittee are making it a top priority. They're not finished yet, but my understanding is that they will greatly increase the national standards across the board for keeping safety, of course, but also trying to reduce light pollution and glare. We estimate that the study, depending on the parameters, would be about $100,000 if it were conducted by a group such as Portland State, with whom we're real familiar. We looked at some of the smaller scope studies, and they were in the $50,000 to $75,000 range. We do believe that our current efforts meet the objectives called for in the bill. There would be some restrictions on the use of state highway funds for studying light that was off the state highway system, of course, but we agree that it's a significant issue, and we're looking forward for ways to participate in the discussion in any direction that the committee indicates. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, for the record, again, Mitch Greenlick, House District 33. It's clear that the bill in its current form probably shouldn't go forward. And I'll try and spend the next couple of weeks working with folks to see if I can create an amendment, amendment to it that would move it beyond where it needs to be. If that turns out not to be possible, I'll let you know, and I'll be working on the in the interim to try and create a to bring together a group of city and county and state people, and to see what the proper direction to move is, whether we need some changes in the state building codes, whether there are some incentives we could create as a part of tax policy to move cities forward in this area. And that probably, this is probably too late in the legislative session to move in that direction, but I'll let you, sir, and your administrator know in the next couple of weeks if I expect an amendment to that, and if not, we'll see it in the next session.
Sounds great, Representative. Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much for hearing us.
Anyone else testify on 2411? Close the hearing on 2411 and open the hearing on 2108.
Don. Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2108 would allow the Division of Motor Vehicles to retain certain documents submitted by individuals at its offices. The department could retain a document if it has reason to believe that it contains false or fictitious information, that it's counterfeit, that it's been altered, was unlawfully or erroneously issued, or is presented by a person who is not in lawful possession of the document. Basically, DMV would have to provide the individual with a reason the document was being retained, the law enforcement agency to which the document will be sent, and the time frame within which the person may contact the law enforcement agency concerning the document. The document would have to be sent to the appropriate law enforcement agency within 2 days after it's retained.
Thank you, John. And Robin, I guess you first.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Robin Freeman. I'm with the Oregon Department of Transportation. With me today on my right is Michael Ward. Michael is the DMV Field Services Manager. Also joining me is Kevin Campbell. Identity theft is a growing problem in this country. The impact upon society and personal lives is costly. The Department of Transportation is proposing a statutory change to assist law enforcement agencies in their efforts to help apprehend people who perpetrate these types of crimes. DMV employees receive training and tools to help identify fraudulent documents and applications. Applicants for driver's license and ID cards must provide proof of age, identity, and residence address. Sometimes these documents are counterfeit, altered, or they do not belong to the person presenting the document. Currently, DMV has limited authority to act when an applicant for a driver license or ID card attempts to assume a false identity. If DMV determines the person is attempting to assume a false identity, such as when a current photo on file does not match the customer at the counter, law enforcement is notified and they may confiscate the documents as evidence and or arrest the customer. People attempting to assume a false identity sometimes guess that DMV suspects them of false identity, and they request that the documents be returned to them, and they leave before police arrive. Currently, DMV must return these documents since we do not have the authority to keep them. Returning fraudulent documents allows the persons to use the documents elsewhere. DMV has authority to suspend a person's driver's license or ID card if DMV determines the person is trying to assume a false identity by giving incorrect information on the application for license or ID. However, DMV does not have statutory authority to confiscate those documents and forward them to law enforcement for investigation. As amended by the Dash 2 amendment, House Bill 2108 gives DMV the authority to retain documents when presented by individuals attempting to assume a false identity if the documents are false, fictitious, counterfeit, altered, or issued in error. and only documents issued by a government agency in the United States will be confiscated. The bill directs DMV to forward the documents to law enforcement for further investigation. Customers will have the opportunity for due process to retrieve the documents if desired, according to the property procedures of the law enforcement agency. If someone is presenting counterfeit or altered documents without attempting to assume a false identity, we will not confiscate those documents, but we will refuse to issue. House Bill 2108, as amended, gives DMV statutory authority to retain documents used in an attempt to assume a false identity if the documents are issued by a governmental agency of the United States. DMV believes that implementation of this bill will help address the growing problem of identity theft and reduce the amount of counterfeit documents circulating in Oregon's communities. With me today, as I mentioned, is Michael Ward. I'd like to have Michael do a presentation for all of you. It's a brief overview of the training that our staff at DMV receives and the tools that DMV uses to identify these documents. He has brought some documents with him that are false documents for you to look at, and we want to be sure we get them back when they get to this end of the dais. So I now will give you Michael Ward.
Thank you, Robin, members of the committee. DMV currently has a fraud ID recognition training program. It consists of 8 hours per every employee. That is, all new employees receive this training as part of their new employee training. And, in fact, we're planning on doing a refresher training for all of our employees this year also. The training includes such things as how to recognize false documents and the different kinds of false documents there are. There are altered documents. That is a genuine document that's been altered in some way to change the identification information listed on that document. There are counterfeit documents, and those are documents that are false. However, they could be printed on or made with genuine materials. And then there are imposter or impersonation documents, which are genuine documents, but they don't belong to the individual who has them. We try to train our individuals or our employees on what to look for in those documents and the security features that they contain. For example, on paper documents such as birth certificates, social security cards, and other documents, we try to demonstrate and show our employees how to look for proper seals, what security paper feels like and looks like, ultraviolet fibers that may be included in that paper, the script or format of the document, something called intaglio printing, which is raised printing, and you'll see that in one of the false documents I present where that's missing, microprinting, and we'll demonstrate that for you today, watermarks, and other kinds of security features you would normally see in a genuine paper document. On plastic documents such as driver's licenses, military ID cards, passports, we also try to show for our employees what to look for in looking at those documents. Such things as the design of the document. Our Oregon driver's license is a unique design to Oregon, just as the North Carolina driver's license is a unique design to North Carolina. The photos, the scripts, the formats of the documents, the security features, the security overlays, the ultraviolet UV features, and we'll demonstrate that for you today also, and microprinting again. We try to train our employees on how to use those tools that I just described. And before I get to the black light and the microprinting, we do have access to ID checking guides that come out once a year, produced for driver's licenses, United States and Canada. This is an international edition for various documents, try to be the latest documents available for us, and just mainly other governmental agencies describing what the security features are in those documents. And I also passed around, I apologize for the quality, the screen prints of a computer application that we have access to called DocuTector. The first page of that document shows the various kinds of identification documents that are contained within the database there, U.S. driver's licenses, federal documents, Canadian documents, international documents, and passports. The second page shows, if you were to select U.S. Federal documents, all of the federal documents that are contained within the database that we can access and try to determine what the security features are and what the most current current and some of the past examples of those documents are. And then the third page indicates, if you go even further into the database, some specific examples of the various documents that are contained there. And what I didn't do is, you can go even further. If you look at that third page, there's also a button that shows show details. Well, if you hit that button, it will go even to greater detail on what some of the security features are for that particular document. So given these tools that we have available to us, we think we do as best we can, or anyone can, in trying to train our employees on what to look for in the documents that we see every day. And now, if I can, I'd like to just demonstrate some of those security features for you. I'll demonstrate them on our new driver's licenses, but this is also, some of these features are also available, are used on other documents that we're trained to look for.
We have a question from DMV.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does DMV require a Social Security number to get a license?
Yes, sir. My first time here. Representative Gilman, Representative Burley. Yes, the last session required DMV to collect Social Security numbers to come into compliance with federal statute around child welfare laws.
And do you check Social Security numbers through this or some means to see if they're a valid number?
Representative Gilman, Representative Burley, no, we don't. The statute that was passed last session was very specific in that we were to collect the Social Security card or Social Security number, but not verify it in any way.
Thank you. Further questions? Go ahead.
Let me see if we can do this without dimming the lights. As I mentioned earlier, we have not very good.
Let's see.
Darkness.
Oh, to see the other picture?
See the Oregon written across.
Oh,
here.
Oh, I see.
That's a new one. And most states are using a UV filter of some sort, or UV a security feature of some sort.
Can you see it without the light or not? Oh, no, it just...
Not very clear.
Not very clearly. There's no shadow. Okay. Let's go to second on the picture. I just can end my glasses.
You can go here. Yeah.
It's got some really bad pictures. Really? Sketch. Picture over.
And I'll demonstrate two features here and then pass it around. That would make it a little easier. On the back of our current license, there's a straight line. Mm-hmm. That's not a straight line, that's microprinting. And so we use our loops. If you look at that real closely, you'll see that it.
Straight line micro.
Light on my glasses.
This is starting to look like Mission Impossible.
It's going to self-destruct.
And then the other feature, if you hold this and call it a decoder, ring where you
get that from the circle.
First Dick Tracy when you need it.
Do I need my shoe phone too?
Right on the pink. In the pink, you should see the Oregon. Oh, you know, I bet it is, and I'm just not seeing it because I don't have glasses. It's in white. Is it in white?
Yeah, it's a little tricky, but if you just sort of rotate this back and forth, you'll see the
light. Oh, cross your eyes.
We're going to need the 8-hour training.
But for Debbie,
we know where we're going. We know that Debbie's not going to be verifying these.
Okay, I was going to look through this. Oh, wow.
So on the back of the license with the loop along that straight line, you'll see it's not a straight line. In fact, words are printed there, and that's a security feature called microprinting. And on the front of the license, in the pink area, as you move that decoder, which is just a sort of a prism, back and forth, you'll see words jump out at you. And that's just a couple of the security features our new license has. As you look at the new license, or maybe you've already seen it, we used a ghost image. That's the second photo down below on the license. Over another security feature, overlapping data, which makes it hard to cut and paste when you're trying to counterfeit a driver's license. As you look at the license, you'll see it go from pink to yellow. That's called gradient color bar fine line patterns. Again, something very difficult for a photocopier to replicate. We also use something called redundant data. That is, the same information is on the license in multiple locations. Someone who's not paying attention to what they're trying to do as a counterfeit document may miss that. Of course, the Oregon seal is positioned over the photo. The Oregon that I showed you with the black light, fairly sophisticated UV. It's actually a tricolor UV, which is very difficult to replicate. You'll see the as you look at Oregon there. We've also, for some of our other stakeholders, have indicated on the driver's license when someone turns 21 and when someone turns 18. If you were to examine the license closely, you would see that there's one letter on the front of the card that's in a different font than the rest of the letters. And I won't tell you that. You can try to... and, of course, on the back of our licenses, we have 1D and 2D barcodes that contain information that a barcode reader would be able to determine if the information contained in the barcode was the same information contained on the face of the license. But as important, although sometimes forgotten, is the card itself. It's I'm not an engineer, but we're told that there's a very sophisticated piece of plastic that makes up our license, and that exposure to heat or chemicals of some sort, of any sort, will warp or significantly deform the license to make it unusable. That was not the case 5 or 6 years ago when DMV was issuing licenses and just getting into a digital photo license. Law enforcement agencies and others tell us that our old licenses were fairly easy to counterfeit and alter. And we hope this new license makes it much more difficult for individuals to do that. And speaking of that, let me just again pass around and show some documents that are counterfeit or altered documents. I don't want to take a lot of your time, but do want to give you some examples. I'll pass around this birth certificate. It's a document that we didn't confiscate. It was left at our counter when we got suspicious of the individual. If you'll look at it, although it's not on white paper, it's not a secure security paper. And I mentioned intaglio printing in most birth certificates or security documents. This fine line border would actually be a raised printing that you could actually feel and determine. This is a fraudulent Social Security card. Some features you look for are just the raised columns on a Social Security card, and the colors is pretty awful. This is an example of an Oregon identification card issued at a truck stop here in Oregon that no one in Oregon here would take. It has Statue of Liberty on it and all kinds of other things. But someone in Arkansas or Missouri or somewhere else might look at this and think it's a genuine Oregon identification card. And here's one of our older driver's licenses that if you were to just look at that, you probably wouldn't think twice about it. But if you look at the seal as it goes around, the seal is very, what's the opposite of crisp? Not very clear. It's very vague. And if you look at the numbers, the red numbers up here closely, maybe even the magnifying glass will help, you'll see that there's some red spillover in some of the layers. My suspicion is that someone heated this license up, peeled back the laminate, and then altered the data beneath it. So...
I'd probably take it because I don't have my glasses on. Okay. Oh, yeah.
I think that's it.
I think think that pretty much wraps up our testimony. If you'd like to ask any questions, we'd be happy to answer those.
Do you want me to go?
Sure.
Okay. Chair Gilman, do you want me to go ahead and testify quickly?
Oh, excuse me. They can wait till everybody's done. Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
I'll try to create more confusion. Chair Gilman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, here today to speak in favor of House Bill 2108 as amended. I think that the amendment accomplishes a couple purposes. I think it most more appropriately focuses on true ID theft cases. And for law enforcement, it reduces the sheer volume of these kind of documents that would be coming into law enforcement offices. The reason I'm here really is to give you the law enforcement spin, or at least a perspective on what law enforcement does when it receives these documents, because they are actually received as an allegation of a crime, and so they become evidence like any other piece of evidence and are treated exactly the same. And of course, when that evidence no longer has evidentiary value, it's returned. It's returned promptly. There's every effort made to try to identify and connect with the person whose documents they are. I know this firsthand because my wife's purse was stolen about 4 months ago. And, of course, our credit cards were used extensively within the first 24 hours. But about a month later, law enforcement arrested a young woman who just happened to be carrying my wife's Social Security number around. And it's different in the sense that this woman never made it to a DMV office, but could. And in that case, where DMV has reason to believe, probable cause is actually the standard they're using for their folks to believe that someone is coming in claiming to be someone else for the purposes of getting identity. That's the very documents we want removed. And I think it's reasonable to remove those documents and then give law enforcement the opportunity to properly process them through the evidentiary standards that we have. I guess the days, based on the previous testimony, the days of just creating your own documents for underage drinking and things like that are gone. I was thinking as he was testifying, and apologize for taking time to even say this, but I had a friend in college, not in this state, and I will not name names, who actually created hundreds and hundreds of these ID cards through his fraternity. But he had a new spin on the whole thing. You know, I've heard of cutting out little pictures and pasting them. He had a huge copy of their license or their driver's license, huge. So all you had to do was stand behind the box and your head was the right size. They took a picture of the whole thing. And so at any rate, that is not likely to happen anytime now in the near future, but I couldn't resist saying it. But I did want to let you know that there is ORS statute that relates to return of evidence. The courts involved in the event that there is no crime filed. I mean, it can be for a number of reasons. It could be for the fact that they don't believe there is a case there, at which time they would release the evidence, to the case where a suspect flees and they don't have a case in that case either. So, but anyway, I wanted to mention from the law enforcement perspective that we're comfortable with the narrowed amendments, and we do think that they more properly get at the identity theft. It seems to be more and more of a problem all the time. So with that, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to share.
Representative Broom.
Yeah, my question, and Robin, you and I discussed this a little bit some weeks ago, is the question of taking and perhaps holding on to foreign issue documents. And first of all, the question arises, I think I know the answer, but I'd like a little bit of discussion on it. Does the DMV accept, say, a foreign passport as part of the documentation needed for somebody that's here legally to acquire a driver's license? And my question is, whereas I have full faith and confidence in the DMV's ability to get the right information, the right training to confiscate U.S. issued documents if they're faulty or obviously counterfeit documents, I have less confidence in our ability to have the training and expertise to do that with foreign issued documents, simply because, and I come from a family that travels quite a bit, the documents are strange, and what may look what may be completely legitimate in some country may look to us like some sort of Xerox half copy thing that's funneled together, and it doesn't have the same quality standards, if you will, but completely legitimate. address that a little bit?
Representative Gilman, Representative Brunn. Yes, our current procedures allow us to accept passports for proof of age and identity. If the passport's in a foreign language, we require that an English translation be a part of that passport, and in most countries that's true. But you raise a good point. Foreign documents are very difficult for us to interpret. There's not a lot of reference material out on a lot of foreign documents, although, as you saw in the DocuTector slides, there is some information available to us through DocuTector and through our international edition that gives us some background around what foreign passports should look like. Some are a little easier to recognize and to determine what the security features are and what we should be looking for, and some aren't. And that gets back to another key component of our training. It's not just the documents in front of us, it's the person there in front of us and all the information contained on that document. And we attempt to train our people to, in a polite and respectful way, ask questions about that material that may determine that they are indeed that person's documents. And sometimes we're able to determine that they're not. But you're right, foreign documents are a bit of a difficulty for us. But again, the amendment is that was made is that we're retaining U.S. issued.
Okay, so that so maybe satisfies the
right. So a passport issued by another country, we would not retain.
You will not take. You may not grant a license, of course.
If we have some concerns around its validity, we would not do that, but we wouldn't retain it.
Correct. Thank you. Yes.
Well, and I respectfully have to take issue with what Representative Brunn said. I mean, I've traveled around the world myself, and in the Soviet Union, when it was the Soviet Union, they took your passport at every hotel and kept it, and on some trains, and I was without my passport most often, and completely at the mercy of who happened to take it. And those were the days when they were very hot items. So this country is one of the only ones I've never had passports taken at some point, you know, in the past. Not so much in Europe anymore, but it's scary. It really is, and that they can do it. But I think the message here is, if you are indeed the owner of that document and it's legitimate and everything, you shouldn't, in this country, I speak for just this country, shouldn't have any problems and shouldn't, you know, they would take it and treat it as such. But if it's not legitimate, then you should be worried, I would hope.
Can I give you a current update on Russia. Did a train trip there last year, and they still take your passport.
Mr. Chairman, your papers are not in order. To the good representative, I agree 100%. My only worry is that with so many countries and so many localities that I don't want to be in a position of acting like a Russian or a communist state where we're arbitrarily taking documents. That's what I want to avoid. So, thank you.
I think that's homeless. More questions? Yes.
Well, I did. Can I have a question? I did have somebody go in to get a replacement license, only the replacement license consisted of my number and my name and their face. And it was caught because the DMV had a picture right there, which thankfully they do have access and utilize technology. But part of the ID that this woman was using was a Bi-Mart card. And, you know, she got as far as getting her picture taken. And I don't know what tipped them off, but I think it was the picture thing. She didn't look like me. But things like that, would they be retained? I mean, I know it's not a government issued document.
Representative Gilman, Representative Thatcher, in our issuing documents, we make a issuing driver's licenses. We make a distinction between the issuance of an original license to you, someone we've not had business with before, whether you're just turning 16 and coming to get your instruction permit, or you're coming from out of state to get an Oregon license for the first time. We have very high standards around that transaction. If, however, you've already had an Oregon driver's license and now for whatever reason it's been lost or stolen, or you're coming in for a renewal, we do allow to take other secondary documents that may not have the same quality as a passport or an original birth certificate, but coupled with the photo on file and our ability to ask you questions around what may be contained on your driver's record, we think we end up with as good an indication that you are who you say you are. So in that case, there is a list of secondary documents, a little less secure, a little less difficult to get as a driver's license or a passport that we do accept for duplicate licenses or renewals. As long as we can verify that you have photos on file and that you can answer questions about your driving record that you would probably be the only one who would know about.
Follow up. Yes, but if you'd retained it, I would have got my Bi-Mark card back.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Andrea Meyer.
We'll see.
Oh, you want to all come up? Okay, that's all right. Ramon, okay.
Ramon had to leave before this. Chair Gilman, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I am here in opposition to this bill today. The bill is intended to deal with attempted use of fraudulent documents to obtain driver's license. Unfortunately, as drafted, this proposal does not have the adequate due process safeguards we believe are essential to protect innocent individuals who will be swept up under this law. We support the amendments drafted by DMV to limit the seizure of only U.S.-created documents. It accurately reflects that DMV staff has no training to determine the authenticity of many types of documents. This proposal would allow government DMV employees to seize and retain documents from individuals based on a DMV customer service representative's belief that such documents are fraudulent. That's a very awesome power we are giving the government. We are deeply concerned that DMV customer service employees do not have the necessary training to identify without any error fraudulent documents. In general, before law enforcement officials can ever seize and retain documents from an individual suspected of criminal activity, the officer must establish probable cause, a legal term that has specific meaning in which officers receive very specific training. Now we are turning over the duty to make that determination to non-law enforcement personnel without the necessary legal training. And even with the best training, however, mistakes do happen. And if the government seizes crucial identification material from an innocent person, there must be a clear and quick process upon which this person can seek to obtain his or her lawful documents. However, as we have discussed with DMV and others, the process set forth in Section 2, Subsection 3 is insufficient. It sets forth the only process due someone whose documents are seized is to simply to provide that person with notice as to where his or her documents are being sent and the timeline to expect when the law enforcement agency will be sent those documents. If any of you have had the experience of losing your wallets, which it sounds like some of you have, you know how important it is in our daily interactions to have identification at hand. And you know how time-consuming it can be to replace those important documents. In addition, for those who are lawful permanent or temporary resident status, federal law requires that they keep these documents on them at all times. These are U.S.-created documents. As such, a wrongful seizure would result in substantial risks to these individuals, including criminal penalties. The fundamental flaw of this proposed law is that nowhere in the statute does it set up a uniform and speedy process due to individuals who are facing wrongful government seizure of their property. Instead, DMV abdicates any responsibility, providing only that this must give you notice as to which local law enforcement agency it's turned over the documents and how many days it will take before you can even track down your documents from that agency. It omits any requirement that you can quickly seek redress from the law enforcement agency to obtain your documents, and it leaves it up to a piecemeal approach, jurisdiction by jurisdiction, providing no assurance to the legislature that a person who has been wrongfully swept into this process will have a speedy recourse. Can you imagine being swept up into the bureaucracy of not only of DMV, but also law enforcement agencies with varying procedural hurdles to jump through to ostensibly prove your innocence? And let's not forget that simply by transferring documents, as this does, from one agency to another, this structure creates additional risks that documents will be lost or destroyed along the way. What if DMV tells you it sent your documents to a law enforcement office 15 miles away? Now, if you've had your license from another jurisdiction seized, how exactly do you lawfully drive there? But assuming you can arrive at this other location during their operating hours, and each local law enforcement office may have differing and limited hours when you can attempt to obtain your documents, creating even more hardship. It is easy to imagine that the person you are told to speak to has no record of your documents, and then you're told to return to the DMV office, which in turn tells you it no longer has your documents because their records show the documents were sent to the law enforcement office. At one time or another, we have all experienced this bureaucratic nightmare, and as this law is written, it's a new form of this nightmare. For all these reasons, the ACLU urges this committee not to move forward with this bill. At a minimum, the law must set forth far more protections than are provided here. This must include a uniform process that is due each individual who believes that his or her documents have been impermissibly seized, providing a speedy and fair process to obtain prompt return. Thank you.
Questions? Go ahead.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, chairman. For the record, my name is Eduardo Angulo. I am the chairman of the Salem-Kaiser Coalition for Equality. We are a coalition of 11 community organizations here in the Marion County area that include PECUN, the Farm Workers Union, CAUSA, the Pro-Immigrant Rights Coalition of Oregon, Mano a Mano Family Center, Latinos Unidos Siempre, our youth organization, Salem-Kaiser NAACP chapter, and Salem-Kaiser NAACP youth chapter, Mecha students from Willamette University, and Juntos students, a Latino organization from Chemegra Community College. Also, we have Citizens for Livable Communities organization being part of our coalition, and Immigrant and Bilingual Parents Association of the Salem-Kaiser School District. I am here not only as the chairman of the coalition, but also as a member of the Latino Task Force that had been put in place by the leadership of the Oregon DMV. We have been attempting to work with them for the past several months in trying to find collaborative ways to deal with these issues of identity theft. You almost know that the Latino immigrant community is also part of identity theft and suffer from the issues of identity theft. The task force, and I will speak on my own, we appreciate that the issue of identity theft is being addressed. However, the Salem-Kaiser Coalition for Equality does not support the approach taken by this bill, because there are less burdensome solutions to address this issue, like improvements in the training and uniform approach in denial of driver licenses or ID cards to those whom the DMV determines are attempting to establish false identity. The danger of this bill is that it will cause the DMV to oversee documents that are legitimate and essential to many members of our community. The absence of documents are very problematic for the community that needs the documents for school, most important for work, going to hospital, employment, loss of time, loss of hardships. We know that the DMV, and this has been addressed at our task force, has a history of simply getting it wrong or turning away the public who might have legitimate, valid documents. This bill proposes to take people's original documents without any articulated steps or proceedings in these bills for its returns. The bill requires the application of probable cause, which is a legal standard for which the DMV staff has not proper training or background. We want the applicants who have their documents retained to be entitled to an immediate hearing, and nothing in this bill provides or try to address this issue. This bill fails to specify when the documents are to be returned. Under federal law, as Ms. Mayor put it well, immigrants are supposed to have their immigration papers at all times. Currently, the DMV is not set up to provide written information on such an important matters in languages other than English and Spanish to the public. We believe that these documents should not be confiscated without the approval of senior DMV personnel. The problems that we're having with this bill touches citizens that are legally here. Their documents will be retained. It is a huge hardship on individuals and on families. And we believe that due process needs to be set up accordingly. We need these documents to be returned in a timely manner. This issue of confiscating documents without having people that have the proper training to differentiate between good and bad documents puts a huge burden on our workers, especially our immigrant and our farm workers here in Oregon, creating a more burden for the economic livelihood of our community. Thank you.
Questions? Yes.
Can you answer what you would consider adequate training?
Well, I would leave that to the experts. I'm not an expert. So I'm sorry, Madam Representative Boone, I wouldn't know how to answer that question. I don't have the training or even attempt to have the knowledge.
Andrew,
Chair Gilman, Representative Boone, I don't have an answer in terms of what criteria needs to be met, but certainly that is, you know, it's hard to fashion that into the legislation in terms of the statutory of what level of training. And I don't know currently what level law enforcement training has, and I know that they testified that they do have some level of training. I think the other testimony you heard was ensuring that it's a higher level of a person, the supervisor role, who's got the authority and more detailed training. And that's what just one piece of the concern is the level of training, no matter how great, will always lead to error. And that's a concern we have, is that the safeguards are there for when the mistakes do happen. You know, I think absolutely there needs to be really sufficient training, and I think they're doing some in terms of what identity and what information and materials are legitimate or not. But wrong documents can and will be taken under this.
And perhaps I should have asked Robin or Mike, how many times do you find it necessary to confiscate these?
Chair Gilman, Representative Boone, in a little bit of a survey that we did not too long ago in preparation for this bill, our best, and I'll use the word guess, is it would probably be a couple times a week. When we limited to U.S. issued documents and not having to deal with foreign issued documents, I think that changes the scope quite drastically. The other thing we're counting on also is some public information and some exposure about this bill might make those who would want to perpetrate identity theft think again about bringing their false documents to DMV. But real hard numbers are, as you might expect, are kind of hard to come by in this kind of scenario. Could I address two questions that came up? In terms of training, the training that we're providing, the training that I described to the committee earlier, is the best training that we can find available across the country. It's produced by the American Association, AMBA,
my mind froze up. American
Motor Vehicle?
Yes, Motor Vehicle Administrators. And I'm sorry, I apologize. It's something they've collaborated on and produced. We've also added to it for materials that we received from other states in terms of what they produced for how to recognize false documents, what false documents look like. So we've not come across any other organization that compiles the kind of extensive training material that we give our employees. And as I said earlier, it's a full day of training, which is quite a bit of training. The one piece I did forget to mention also in terms of the comment around a senior DMV manager looking at the documents, the procedure that we would put in place is that before documents were confiscated, a second pair of eyes would review the documents and collaborate with the original counter clerk and determine if indeed these documents were false. In most cases, that's going to be an office manager, although we don't have office managers in every office. We do have lead workers in the other. So an office manager or a lead worker will review those documents and the circumstances around which we were looking at confiscation before the decision to confiscate the document was made.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not the expert in this training. I don't have a clue if it's good or not. But I must ask, you are saying it's not good enough, yet when asked, you don't offer any standards or specifics on why you're saying it's not good enough.
Chair Gilman, Representative Burley, my testimony isn't focused on how adequate the training is. I can't speak to specifically the training because I'm not there. My testimony is that in past, and Ramon Ramirez is also here and hopefully will testify, folks who have worked or attempted to work within DMV providing documents have had problems when they're lawful legal documents. So we start with that threshold, that there are problems already. The focus of my testimony is when mistakes happen, what's not in this legislation is the due process aspect to it. But there has been a history in the various communities who can testify, and Eduardo has a bit, and I think Ramon will as well, to their experiences of providing lawful documentation and being rejected over and over again or turned away or having difficulties. So it's with that framework that we're concerned, and even the best trained can make mistakes, and that's why we think the due process has to be in there.
Right. And would you please come back up?
I have a question for them as well.
And I thank you. I appreciate that answer because that's where I wanted to go next, too.
Andrea Meyer.
You're an attorney, I believe, if I remember correctly. Yes?
Right. I'm the legislative director. I happen to be an attorney.
The question is, I'm not the attorney here. She is, I'm on thin ice here, but you have the evidence, the chain of custody, of the evidence. And I think they make a very, very good point, is that if the document is retained, a person needs to know basically where it is at all times. Who has it? When did it go from one agency to the next? How are we going to address that concern, which is a very real concern in my mind?
Representative Gilman, Representative Burley, the process that we envision would indicate that if we were going to confiscate someone's documents, we would have a form that we would hand the individual that would tell them who the contact was in the local law enforcement agency, where the documents would be sent to, and we would give them a time frame in which we think that document would happen. In some small communities, we could probably hand carry the document to that law enforcement agency. It could be a local city police. It could be law and county. It could be the state police. I'm not sure which. It depends on where the field office is located. In other cases, we would use the mail to get that document to the law enforcement agency. We would use certified mail so that we would have a receipt and try to minimize any chances that the document would be lost in the mail and get that to the law enforcement agency as quickly as we can.
Chair Gilman.
Well, no, I've never seen fire over here. So.
Okay.
Well, let me think about that.
Okay.
I was working on eye contact there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to DMV. If you had this authority, and I think you made mention of it before, but would you be posting notices at DMV offices or saying that caution or fraudulent documents will be retained, or more of a public relations media type thing?
Chairman Gilman, Representative Beyer, yes. Almost all the time, every time we make some changes in our procedures as a result of legislation or other actions, we try to inform the public with press releases, make sure our website's updated with that information, and post bulletins and posters in our field offices to indicate what that new change has been. And I would say we would do the same thing in this case also.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, again, directed back toward the DMV. This may be a mamby-pamby question. I fully admit that. But one of the issues that I would have, especially in a situation where the DMV potentially made a mistake addressing their concern, is undue embarrassment for the person at the counter that's dealing with this. And I don't want to over-stereotype, but the stereotype, if you will, the DMV, the lines, and people, you know, impatient waiting behind. And we've all been in those situations, you know, maybe the grocery line or with somebody else where we've seen a situation where somebody's check hasn't cleared. They're just embarrassed, whether it's justified and deserved or not. Is there a way, what is current procedure in this situation? Are folks sort of taken around to a side or to the back so they're not in public view to be potentially embarrassed, or how is that managed now, and is that something that could be addressed if you implement this new program?
Representative Gilman, Representative Brunn, the whole idea of treating our customers with respect and dignity is at the core of our customer service values. And you need to keep in mind, if I could be so bold, that we deal with lots of individuals who have medical problems, other things that affect their driving that we have to be sensitive to and deal with them in a way that's not embarrassing. The way we would deal with this situation is along those same lines. We would try to inform the customer why we have apprehensions or hesitations around their documents, what we think is wrong with them, try to avoid the embarrassment issue so that we can still do our job, and that is take false documents off the street, but not cause undue embarrassment. And quite frankly, in a lot of the situations that we see today, when we walk in our process today, when we believe that there is an application for false identity here, we actually walk the applicant through the entire process. As Kevin indicated, Kevin Campbell, we need to provide the evidence that will be sustainable in a court action. So we have them sign the application that says they are who they are, and there's a statement on there that says that's a crime if you're doing that. We take your photo so that we have as much information as we can to provide law enforcement with the evidence and the documents they would need to prosecute a crime. And in lots of cases where we stall for time, as we call the local agency, people get up and leave, so we're stuck with the documents. But in that whole chain of events, it's not our intent to embarrass or humiliate the customer, and that would be at the center of our customer service approach here. Yes, we may take your documents away from you because we believe they're fraudulent, but it's not our intent to embarrass or humiliate anyone.
Further question?
Yeah, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said that you Michael, you said that DMV would require the second review if you're going to retain the documents. That's not in the draft. And you said that the draft does say within 2 business days of retaining, the department shall forward, but it doesn't say how. And I think the other witnesses have a good point here because, you know, in the city of Bend, they may just drive it over to the police station. So they get it that day. But in Multnomah County, they may stick it in the mail, and that could take a week. And the individual who had the documents retained, they don't know. So how can we work on that? How could we make that a little bit more user-friendly, so to speak? And maintain, I think this chain of custody is really important here because, as Eduardo pointed out, I mean, if it's certain documents for certain individuals, it could be a very, very serious issue for them.
Representative Gilman, Representative Burley, it is I would agree it's a critical issue for us to deal with in terms of further amendments to the bill or how we can work on it. It's certainly DMV's intention to be very, very clear that when we take a document, we have a very high likelihood that it's a fraudulent U.S. issued document, and use whatever means that we can to ensure that the document gets to the local law enforcement agency. As you pointed out, it will be different from county to county. In some cases, it will be the county sheriff. In some cases, it will be OSP, I'm sure. In other cases, it will be the local city police. And it'll be incumbent on us to work out that process so that the documents get into the law enforcement agency's hands as quickly as possible.
Thanks.
And then the next question would be, to follow up my last one, how often has it happened that you were wrong? You had 1 to 2 a week.
Yeah, Representative Gilman, Representative Boone, I really don't know. We don't have a good process in place now for tracking that because we can't confiscate documents. We don't hear back from law enforcement on many occasions around what was the disposition of the case when we called them and provided them with our application that had been signed and our statements around what we thought was a fraudulent application. So I just really don't know. I'm sorry.
You don't hear back. Okay.
No, I don't know. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is one of those points where I'm sorry that I didn't explore this a little bit more or at all with Mr. Campbell, who was in here representing the chiefs of police, because I think he raised some issues that I wish I could have addressed to him, because I do know that our police force, all of them, not just local city, I mean, all of them, are really, understaffed, have a hard time processing caseloads, and I'm kind of curious how well they are going to deal with these when they get them and what the loss rate would be. So I'm not sure what your intentions on this bill are today, but I have a few questions to ask first.
We're not going to get past work session. Okay. I mean, we're not going to work session. Okay. It sounds to me like there's already a possibility of another amendment to it. And so we're not going to do anything with it today.
Yeah. Sure.
And we can make sure that Campbell comes back to answer those questions. Other questions here on this side?
Okay. Chair Gilman, may I wanted to, if I may, respond a little bit more to Representative Burley, because you all are beginning to narrow in on some of the, the procedures required. And this bill does have some process. It's just what it's omitting, and you're catching a lot of it. It does have a process of you getting a piece of paper that says we're seizing it and why. And it does have a process to which you're told you can first contact law enforcement agency, and it does have a process that they must get it to them within 2 days, business days, but you've identified the problems of what method will be used to get it to them. The process that they're abdicating and they're kind of giving over to law enforcement, and it's not just going to be the chiefs of police because it's going to be the sheriff, it's going to be all sorts of different law enforcement, is what happens when it arrives there? Is there someone who can make a timely investigation? I go there and say, okay, you have my documents now for, it's 5 days since I got the notice. It's business days. You finally got it now. You finally tell me you have the document. Well, now you need to investigate. I need my documents back now. There needs to be some speedy process with these kind of very important documents. And unless we put it in the statute, that's not going to rise up to that. And if the innocent person's caught in, they're in a morass of, look, I know where my documents are, but I have no process that's going to achieve me getting them back quickly. Because investigations can take time. So I appreciate that this committee is hearing the issues and the process, and that's due process. What process are you due? So, Representative Burley, you can sound like a lawyer if you want.
Representative Boone.
Well, with that being said, then, is there a way that you would suggest that it be expedited, such as, I'm not suggesting this, but just as an idea, a Xerox copy of the identification paper that's been confiscated? Because it concerns me if DMV is seeing 1 to 2 a week that they have determined that very likely are fraudulent, that says something to me. That they're either very, and if this is one, I don't know if it's all one type of document that they're seeing or whatever, but whatever that document is, if it's all the same one, maybe they need to revisit and comment on how that's produced. And do you have any advice that you could give that you would like to see, short of this just going away?
Well, Chair Gilman, Representative Boone, let's see. Do I have any advice? Yes, I'd like something put in the statute that sets forth a clear time frame that everyone must comply with. I have been talking to DMV. I'm a part of the Latino Task Force. I brought this forward to them right away when it was in an LC form. I spotted our concerns. I said we have concerns about this. We need due process in there. And we're here today without any amendments on it. So I continue to be interested in working and very clear about setting up a very narrow timeline. In the statute saying, you know, you must provide an opportunity for someone to seek return of their documents within a very specific amount of time. I mean, I the other little aspect I worry about, just I don't want us to forget as we have problems in terms of law enforcement offices being able to operate 24/7. Some of them are shut down. Some of them may not have the person at the window that you have to go talk to except for very narrow hours. And if you are working, that's a real struggle. So I don't mean to keep throwing in problems, but there needs to be something in the statute that's very clear about when you take these kind of documents from someone, we are going to treat these really different. And we're going to consider that all law enforcement entities must work quickly to investigate and or release if the person shows up whose documents they are. And we're talking about those who are going to show up to law enforcement and say, these are my documents because there's been a mistake. Not talking about when they are fraudulent documents. It's unlikely that that person will show up at the desk of law enforcement and say, return those to me. So we're talking about the innocent people being swept up.
Okay. Yes.
Well, I just wanted to clarify that too, that if you have any comment on the, and I think I heard you say it was just the U.S. produced documents, and then do you have any comment on the fact that 1 to 2 a week is popping up?
Chair Gilman, Representative Boone, you know, Mike, when we had talked, I wasn't sure that was the same number that we had talked about a while ago. I thought it was a far more rare a situation than when we met and discussed it. So I just want us to all be on the same page, because my understanding was this is pretty rare. I mean, obviously they have, in the past, what they do is, you know, they haven't been able to. They call law enforcement, and if law enforcement arrives in time, they can turn them over. So this is, you know. So.
Yes, sir. Question. You want to talk about a couple times a week?
Representative Gilman, Representative Boone. Yes, I believe the study showed it was about that kind of average. Around the state, it's an average. It might be a little higher in the metropolitan areas, a little lower elsewhere, but on average, I think that's the...
So it's the average of the state, then?
Right. Over time. It's a very difficult number to try to get a handle on, however.
And you indulge me with one
more?
And I know you can't, they're all, it's different around the state, but is there one item that pops up in particular that you're seeing the more of?
Chairman Gilman, Representative Boone. No, it's quite examples of several, whether it's bad social security cards or out-of-state driver's licenses we have suspicions about, or birth certificates. No, there's not one that jumps out other than the others.
Sorry, I'm trying to decide if I'm slow. I just want to clarify. when you say 1 to 2, I'm trying to figure out if you're talking per office or just statewide.
Statewide.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Representative Gilman, Representative Byer. Okay. But, you know, I will make a note to myself and go back and find that study and just, you know, if the numbers are different than what I've said here today, I certainly want to correct the record. But that's my recollection of what the frequencies are.
Yes.
I guess this is really probably just a comment, but it's not, you know, I'm not quite as concerned about the number. I mean, the purpose of this bill, I don't think there's any disagreement amongst any of us that the purpose of this bill is a good one, and that is to deal with the ever-increasing problem of identity theft. But it's that one, and you know, nothing's ever going to be perfect. Somebody's always, unfortunately, going to fall prey to something like this. But I guess I'd like to see a little more discussion put on trying to figure out how to make the process work a little bit better so that we
you know, we know where the document is and people know exactly how this is going to work. I'm not real crazy about passing a bill telling every law enforcement agency in the state, city, sheriff, et cetera, that they're all going to do the same thing. I'm not quite, you know, I don't think I can support something like that, but I'm wondering if maybe through rulemaking or something we have some kind of a process more clearly identified for folks. I don't know what the answer is, but I think maybe we need a little more discussion on that.
Okay, Robin, your thought.
Thank you, Chair Gilman, Representative Burley. Just a comment. We do have pretty extensive procedures around processing false applicants and suspected false applicants. And I think that's what you were asking. Do we have processes in place, not for confiscating documents, but we do for processing false applications and refusal? And I can get a copy of that to you so you can have an idea of our thought process and what we actually have in place, but it's about 9 pages, and it's fairly lengthy, and there's a lot of thought that's been put into this. We would go through a very similar process if we were going to actually be confiscating these documents. And I'm sorry Kevin Campbell isn't here today, because we have talked to them about, you know, when things get turned over to law enforcement, what happens then? I mean, it's a valid concern, and DMV has asked them about that, and he does really need to speak to that. But it's my understanding law enforcement currently confiscates documents right now, and there is a process. They're tied to statute about how they can process those. It's about evidence, and I'm sorry I can't address your concerns or answer those questions, but I think that Kevin Campbell could certainly come in and address those concerns for you about how they process documents today that they confiscate. Thank you.
Further questions?
Sure.
Okay.
I think Ramon Ramirez.
Ramon, will you come up?
Good afternoon, committee. For the record, my name is Ramon Ramirez, president of the Oregon Farm Worker Union, PICUN, and we currently have about 5,000 farm workers, members of our union. I would say about 95% of our membership are immigrants from either Mexico or Central America. I just want to say that that I'm here to testify in opposition to HB 2108, but I do that reluctantly because I'm a member of the Latino Task Force formed by the Department of Motor Vehicles, and we have been in discussions with the department over this particular issue. I do support the thrust behind the bill, because I think that, as everybody testified, you know, I think identity fraud is a serious issue. I would say more importantly in our community, I mean, it's something that we're dealing with a lot, and it's not a simple thing about education where you can put up posters and stuff and say, because, you know, people that are going to commit crimes are going to do it regardless, right? They're not going to listen. You know, that's not who we're targeting at. I just want to highlight a couple of things from the different testimony that took place. I think the number one concern that we have in terms of identity theft or around this bill is the confiscation of immigrant what's called the visa cards, or they're officially called I-551s. It's the permanent residency cards. Those are the things that we're most concerned with, because that's what we've seen a history of. I have worked on about 5 cases of members who have come to me, and we've had to either intervene on their behalf. One case was involving a person that went to a local police department, try to get fingerprint. This is before they went to the electronic digital fingerprint to get citizenship. And the permanent residency card, they're all being made in one center in Texas. And sometimes they're a little bit off. Sometimes the color's a little bit darker. But it's a valid immigration card. It's your permanent residency. It's proof that you are living in the country and working in the country legally. And this individual got his card not only confiscated, but didn't get it back at all. And called the police department, couldn't get a hold of INS that day. It took them a couple days to get a hold of INS. And then when they finally found out that it was a valid document, they wouldn't get it back. And we've seen this problem time and time again. I say like five cases that I've worked on that I clearly have worked on. One was involving the Marion County Sheriff here in Marion County, and the three other ones were involving state police, where they confiscated these immigration cards that were happened to be valid in all cases. The problem that I see is that, you know, it's not only the embarrassment, and it's not only, you know, the hassle of the problem is that there's a financial loss to this. I mean, the immigration card costs anywhere about $300 now. It costs about $15 to $40 for the photographs. You got to make an appointment at least probably about 30 days out to get your digital fingerprint sent to the FBI center. Now, all that is being processed now in one office, and there's a big backlog, right, because they want to get everybody fingerprinted digitally now. And then including that, you have wage loss. I mean, it isn't that you can go on the weekends, because you got to go during working hours. So the person taking off time from work is going to lose some money and time loss. So I think there's got to be something worked out. There's got to be a way. I mean, we're not going to satisfy everybody. And I'm just for, you know, going after identity fraud and getting those people that are committing that, and let's lock them up. Let's, you know, up for that. The thing that I would recommend is a process where maybe not a uniform process, police department, because everybody works differently, but you are dealing with three or four different entities, and at least there's got to be a process where, you know, if the person's document was confiscated and it's a valid document, that they first, right now, first of all, understand that that document isn't to be destroyed or lost or thrown away. And that's got to be really, really spelled out, that these documents got to be returned back to DMV or something like that. I don't know how we can work that out. That's, you know, we can talk about that. But certainly sending a strong message, don't destroy them. Because on the five cases that I've worked on, all of the documents were destroyed, were never returned to the individuals. And the individuals had to, pay for them again. So that's what I would recommend, first and foremost, that. You know, we talk about respect and dignity. We're talking about most of these people are immigrants. They're low-paid workers. And for, you know, having to pay, you know, $300-$400 up to $1,000, it's a small fortune for people. So I would say that we could work this out. I'm pretty sure we can. And I think if we do, we can come up with a good bill.
Thank you. Questions? Nope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you're obviously the second person that has referred to this task force that DMV has going, and I'm not that familiar with it, but can you give me any idea how long you've been meeting?
I believe I was out of the country when they first met. I believe back in December.
Okay.
So we've had about, I believe, three meetings, and we're going on our fourth meeting.
Thank you.
And I applaud the DMV for doing that. I mean, trying to get the community involved. I think it's it's a courageous move to bring in the community and to get input. I just think we just need a little bit more, and then we can get the job done.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you, Ramon.
Thank you for having me here. Really appreciate it.
I'm not even going to ask if anyone else wants to testify, because everybody that's in the room has already testified.
Always.
Close the hearing on 2108. John, anything else before the committee?
We're done.
Good.
Are we? Not that I'm going to be here, but it's going to be a Friday meeting.
Not this week.
No Friday meeting.
Following
week. There will be one.
Meeting's adjourned.